WFSU-FM now presents a delayed broadcast of the January 16, 2013 luncheon meeting of the Capital Tiger Bay Club. This program was recorded at the Tallahassee Leon County Civic Center.
Good afternoon, Capital Tiger Bay. I am Laurie Walker, Tiger Bay president, and I swear I have not used any performance-enhancing drugs to achieve this status as president. I swear. Really. I mean it this time. Really. I mean, I dare you to test me. Go ahead. I dare you.
Meet me after the meeting.
Uh-oh. Only if Oprah asks me. Well, now we're on to our head table. To my far left, we have City Commissioner Gil Ziffer. Gil?
Yes.
Okay. Next to Gil, thank you. Okay. Next to Gil is Sheriff Larry Campbell. And of course, our speaker, who will be introduced momentarily. To my far right is Tony Carvajal with the Collins Center for Public Policy. Jeff Ryan, a fundraiser for the Florida Democratic Party. Steve Burtman, Government Relations Manager for Humana. And the very meek and mild Elise Judell with Bryant Miller Olive, who will introduce our speaker. Ms. Judell.
Thank you, Madam President, and welcome everyone to the first program of 2013 for Tiger Bay. What could be more appropriate for the first Tiger Bay meeting of the new year than a program about how to choose a husband and make peace with marriage? That is what Florida's premier political club has been about for all of its 40 plus years, and we never shirk from the burning issues of the day. Now, I haven't actually read our speaker's book, since I don't think it's going to be released until next month, but you know that has, this forward-looking club always goes ahead and never waits to actually read a book before we pile on and criticize it. Now, Suzanne Venker brings to us her secret inside knowledge of the workings of men and women and the incalculable damage done to them by feminism. Her insights come to her from her background as a teacher turned social author and social critic, a twice-wed mother of two and niece of the arch ERA opponent, Phyllis Schlafly. That, and presumably not being a man. With books to her credit, like The Seven Myths of Working Mothers, Why Children and Most Careers Just Don't Mix, as I'm sure many of you know, and Flip Side of Feminism, What Conservative Women Know and Men Can't Say, and most recently, the article, The War on Men, last November. Mrs. Venker has found a platform to get herself out of the humdrum life of a housewife and onto talk shows and a book. She has found a platform to examine what the sexual revolution has done to marriage and the family. It appears that feminism taught women that men are idiots. And an inconvenience. We learn that feminists are negative by nature and believe all women are oppressed, and not that real women are all conservatives, but we hear that any time a woman in America pulls the Democratic lever, she sabotages her own future, as many of us have been doing for years. Now, I do admit to feeling a bit of malaise, low these last 45 years or so. Until now, I did not understand this was caused by feminism. I did not realize I was so angry and defensive because I had overstepped my bounds by clawing my way up the pedestal once reserved for men and then falling off my own woman's pedestal in the process. I should have seen that slippery slope coming when Tiger Bay let me become a member. Men, Mrs. Venker tells us, are really pissed off. Women aren't women anymore. We have undermined men's ability to become self-sufficient in the hopes that someday they could support a family. Men want to love women, not compete with them. But modern women won't let them. And you know what? I see now it's true. It's all our own fault, ladies. We women are too aggressive and too needy. We worked our butts off to be as good as men, and now they have to try to keep up with us. It's really too much. It's just too much to ask. We need to relinquish some of the control and let the men be the men. And that is catching on everywhere. Hillary got the message. She's moving out of the way. Susan Rice graciously stepped aside for John Kerry. Valerie Jarrett has that female intuition that just tells her to stay out of sight in those White House photos. Lori, I think it's shameless what you did in that coup d'etat overthrowing poor Tim Center to become president of Tiger Bay. And then asking me here today to introduce our speaker as if there was no man who was, well, man enough to do it. Look at poor Steve Burtman. You can just see in his eyes that he fears he's not good enough. Well, I, for one, am done. This feminism stuff is too hard. I want to give in to my true nature and cede back the territory that rightfully belongs to real men. Steve, come up here. Damn it, man. You are good enough to introduce our speaker. Have at it. And good luck choosing a husband.
Ladies and gentlemen, Suzanne Venker.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was very interesting. I definitely can say I've never experienced that yet. But I will say it does kind of prove a point, one of the points that I've made very often, which is that the subject of feminism and how it's affected our lives as women is so personal, so deeply personal, so deeply rooted, that any thought, excuse me, that a person would, throw out a different way of thinking about that subject is horrific. So horrific that we have to either make fun or just blast right out of the water. Last night, I had a really interesting experience. Remind me, what was the name of where I was, Liz? Thank you, the Village Square. Which, by the way, Tallahassee is a very interesting place. I have learned so much in the last 36 hours about how you guys think, how you operate. You're so engaged, both politically and just civically, and I've actually never seen anything like it. We don't have this in St. Louis, or at least I'm not a part of it, maybe. But it's really neat to see. It's very cool. But I was at this Village Square, and it ended up being a little bit of a lesson, I think, for the woman, Liz Joyner, who some of you may know, who orchestrated the event. And she was having trouble putting a panel together and getting things just so. And she had an interesting experience. She had told me or warned me that that particular group that I was speaking with yesterday was maybe center left, let's say. And she had been real focused on this idea that the Village Square is about bringing Democrats and Republicans together and having a nice dialogue and coming together. What she didn't know is that there's a very big difference between trying to have Democrats and Republicans come together and feminists and non-feminists come together. And she didn't realize, and what she learned is that, wow, that's a whole different ballgame. So while she was sort of prepping me for the left-right thing, it actually doesn't matter. So what I have learned in my work is that feminists and non-feminists are a completely different group. I know feminists who are Republican, and there are Democrats who do not consider themselves feminists. So if there's anything that I've learned over the years that I've been writing and speaking and talking about these issues, it is that it really is its own separate thing. So people really often want to talk about it in terms of right or left or conservative and liberal, but it really isn't. So I'd like to talk to you for a moment, if I may, about ideology. We've probably heard a lot, I know I have, I'm sure you have, in the media over the last 10 years, especially since the whole media bias craze kind of came on board since Bernard Goldberg's book Bias in 2004. And we hear a lot about ideology, right? Bill O'Reilly talks a lot about ideology. And he wrote a book called The Culture Warrior, which some of you may have read, where he said basically that America is divided up into two groups. You have the secular progressives and the traditionalists. And the reason why he uses those terms is because it's so much better than conservative and liberal, because I bet there's people in this room who don't really think of themselves as either conservative or liberal. Kind of depends on the topic, right? So they don't like those labels. But the secular progressive versus the traditionalist is much more, I thought anyway when I read it, accurate. Much more accurate, especially as it pertains to my issue. Because there's absolutely no question that there is a huge chasm between the feminist mindset or ideology and the non-feminist, for lack of a better word, ideology. They are really, it's really about secular progressive agenda versus a traditionalist agenda. So when we talk about feminism, what we're really talking about is ideology. And some people, a lot of people, hold on to that ideology so strongly that they are incapable of being challenged and having that framework that they've been raised with and that they believe in, that they've made choices on, questioned in any way. So yesterday when I was at this Village Square, I ended up on a panel with three feminists and me, and the whole room full of feminists. So it was almost like going into, I don't know, a gender study class or something in on campus and just going into a place where everybody has fully believed in this one thing. And so it's not really a dialogue, it's more like a bubble. That's how I felt yesterday. So it was just this bubble, this experience where everybody sort of talks and thinks the same way. And then when all of a sudden the outsider comes in to challenge it, people get a little upset. So here was one interesting, when we got to the end of the discussion, and we talked about all kinds of things related to women's issues, what we call women's issues, but relationships, sex, marriage, motherhood. The women on the stage wanted to talk a little bit more about broader feminist issues like rape, the rape culture and whatnot. But we covered a lot of territory. And because I was there, I'm assuming I was there to expound upon what I do and the subject that I delve into, which is marriage and motherhood and sex and relationships, I kept pulling it back to that when it came to feminism, as opposed to going to these other places. And at the end, it was a Q&A period, and the very first question that was asked, which I wrote down here because I knew I wouldn't remember it, was someone said, and they're anonymous, the fact that this conversation has revolved almost entirely on relationships, marriage, and motherhood shows how far we haven't come. I thought that was fascinating. And it sort of summed up certainly where the panel was going, because obviously we weren't agreeing, and where I could tell a lot of the audience was going, because I could tell from their facial expressions when I spoke what they thought. It just encapsulated for me exactly why I do what I do. So I happen to believe that relationships and marriage and parenting are the most important things in life. I happen to think family is the most important thing in life. I think that's why we're here. It's a much larger message than the one that the women in this particular group and women like them are capable of hearing. because it's getting at something that is so, I don't know if offensive is too strong of a word, but for them, not the reason we're here. You know, their whole goal is money, power, making it in a way that is not traditional, and so for women, so that it's sort of a battle between, you can either be important at home or you can be important outside the home. And feminists very much believe that you can't do both. Or they want the focus to be more on what goes on outside the home. There's a lot of misinformation about this topic. One of the things that I find is that a lot of people who haven't read anything that I've written, they make assumptions, and I get it all the time. Because let's face it, it is easy to take anything out of context and just have a field day with it. I don't know. Actually, being here is kind of easy next to Stephen Colbert, who spent about 5 to 7 minutes on me and my article about 2 weeks ago, or a month ago maybe. And when someone in the family first emailed it and said, Stephen spent 5 minutes bashing Suzanne last night on whatever. And I've never actually seen Stephen Colbert, so I wasn't going to watch it. But then I did, and I thought it was really funny, actually. You can take anything out of context and have a field day. But the point is, what I have found is that the people who actually do take the time to read what I've written, their response is, well, that's not at all the picture that I got from the media or the speaker or whoever. In fact, what you said kind of makes sense. I kind of agree. Shh, don't tell anyone. That's what I get all the time. And it makes me keep going because that's not right. Those folks have feelings and thoughts that are being squelched because they're not politically correct. I hate political correctness. I'm going to read you something from my last book. It's not the How to Choose a Husband book, because I'm not sure, I couldn't decide whether this was really the right group for that particular book. My target audience for How to Choose a Husband is really 20 and 30 somethings. So some of you might have 20 and 30 somethings children, but your whole, if you're over, I don't know, 50, your whole take on marriage and sex and gender relations is going to be very, very different from the 20 and 30 somethings. So I don't know how much of you guys are really in touch with what's happening with that age group. As I say, if you have children, you certainly are that age. You are. But so I didn't think this was really the best group necessarily to read from that book. But since the subject is feminism, I thought I would read a little bit from my last book, if I may. And then I was going to go right from there to questions. Is that good? Okay. I'm going to take some water now, just a sec. When it comes to women in America, progress is the operative word. According to the Free Online Dictionary, progress means steady improvement as of a society or civilization. It's a relative term. How to improve something is entirely subjective. Yet when we talk about women in America, progress is never defined, debated, or qualified. The topic is misleading right out of the gate. For the past several decades, it has been widely accepted that women in America usually, if not always, get the short end of the stick. According to feminists, women have been oppressed for centuries. We're told not enough progress has been made and that society still hasn't leveled the playing field. This philosophy is so embedded in our culture that Americans don't question it. We don't even label it feminist to think this way. It's just commonplace to believe women suffer discrimination. Turn on the television, flip through a magazine, or search America's airwaves, and you'll be deluged with stories about women who wonder how their needs can best be met, how they can balance their lives better, or how they can deal with the myriad of problems and dangers they face. Women's grievances dominate the conversation. But grievances are like crabgrass. The more heat they get, the more it spreads. And that is precisely what has happened with modern women. Feminist organizations even promote the growth of grievances by consciousness-raising sessions, where feminists exchange tales of how badly some man treated them and then what government's role should be as compensation. In the meantime, buried beneath the surface lies the truth. American women are the most fortunate human beings who have ever lived. No one has it better. Millions of Americans think progress requires women's liberation, not just from marriage and children, but from being female. To feminists, being female is a handicap. The saddest part of this misguided view of human nature is that it hasn't made women any happier. In fact, it has done just the opposite. According to a 2007 report from the National Bureau of Economic Research, quote, as women have gained more freedom, more education, more power, they have become less happy. The authors of this report, Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfer, suggest the salience of the women's movement fueled elation in the 1970s that has dissipated in the ensuing years. That isn't surprising. Most women in America are a right of center bunch and don't want what women on the left want. And that's not my opinion, that's actually from research. The majority of women in this country are traditionalists, that goes back to my comment about secular progressives versus traditionalists, and don't want to change America. Feminists do. They've spent decades trying to convince women that America needs to accommodate them so women can be unshackled, free, and presumably happy. It's an alluring concept. Certainly women like the idea of being free from their responsibilities from time to time. They may like the thought of being liberated from husbands and children occasionally. Who wouldn't? Marriage and motherhood require a lot of work and sacrifice. But most women don't want to be free if being free means being single, dependent on the government, or even being a big shot powerhouse with no time for family. Most women in America want the same thing, lasting love. The female left wants something else. Quote, as we approach a new century and a new millennium, it's the men who have to break through to a new way of thinking about themselves and society, wrote Betty Friedan in the 2001 edition of her 1963 landmark book, The Feminine Mystique. Too bad women can't do it for them or go much further without them, because it's awesome to consider how women have changed the possibilities of our lives since we broke through the feminist mystique only two generations ago. Those powerful words helped to shape a generation of American women. Implicit in her worldview is the notion that women are oppressed and that men are the ones who need to change. Friedan believed the odds are severely stacked against women. The only way to eliminate female oppression, she said, is to change men and society, to create a different America, one that's more fair and just to women. Those who are tempted to write off Betty Friedan as a has-been shouldn't. Her words live on in the minds of influential female leftists whose goals are no different from Friedan's. In November 2009, Maria Shriver, along with the left-wing think tank, it's a hard word to say, phrase, Center for American Progress, produced an exhaustive 400-page document entitled The Shriver Report, A Woman's Nation Changes Everything. Its fundamental argument is that government policies and laws, quote, continue to rely on an outdated model of the American family. Shriver and company, which includes Oprah Winfrey, seek to remedy the supposed problem we are living, by proving we are no longer living in a man's world, but are now living in a woman's world. They consider the traditional family a thing of the past, which is fine with them, because what feminists really want is a matriarchy. And now they've admitted it. The Shriver Report boasted, quote, as we move into this phase we're calling a woman's nation, women can turn their pivotal role as wage earners, as consumers, as bosses, as opinion shapers, as co-equal partners in whatever we do, into a potent force for change. Emergent economic power gives women a new seat at the table, at the head of the table. Just 2 months ago, I'm not sure how many of you got wind of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's comment. She was asked what an acceptable number of Supreme Court justices would be, in her mind, what she thought an acceptable number would be, and she said, now the perception is, yes, women are here to stay. And when I'm sometimes asked, when will there be enough? And I say, when there are nine. people are shocked. I'm going to stop there, if I may, because when I've done this before, I've often found that the Q&A section is very vibrant, and people have lots to say, and I want to hear from you, and I'm sure everybody else does too, and I never get to everybody's questions, so I think I'd rather go right into that.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I know this is not a shy group, so Tiger Bay members only, please. We have a microphone in the middle of the room if you'd like to ask Ms. Venter a question.
Is it on? It is. I was curious if majority of women are traditionalists instead of secular progressives, how did President Obama carry the women's vote?
That's a great question. In the last election, I mean 2008, 70% of unmarried women voted for Obama. 70%. That makes a statement. The majority of people who voted the other way are married women. When you don't have the traditional family unit in place, when you basically don't depend on a husband or the family unit, you're going to have to depend on the government. Obama is more than happy to take care of you financially. And that is one of the reasons that he gears his message to women in general, but specifically to single women. I don't know if you got hold of The Life of Julia. Anybody in here read The Life of Julia? He, in that, I don't know if you call it document, proposal, what have you, he takes a woman, fictional woman named Julia, and shows her lifespan from birth to retirement. And all along the way, she's basically on the dole. So she has assistance from the government, from him, to replace what traditionally would have been taken care of by the family unit and was decades ago. So it's kind of like it's one or the other. And so those people who do not have that traditional family setup are going to be very much enticed by the things that President Obama says. Does that answer your question?
I think a lot of us throughout our life have grown to see that all of us are somewhere on a bell curve with mm-hmm. respect to the way that we think and process our social relations and things like that. And also, I think a lot of us have seen the benefits of diversity with people working together in various ways of processing information. I'm wondering if you have found it useful with respect to your cultural and social goals to politicize these things, such as the constant tension and progress movement between traditionalism and progress and all of that. Do you think have you found it useful to politicize your cultural concerns and turn them into economic government policy and things like that, or has it hindered your social and cultural work?
It wasn't helpful or neither, I guess. My last book was very political in nature. My first and my one coming out next week is not. So I have actually mixed feelings about my last book in terms of having gone into the political realm with it, because actually, if you're asking me just for me, for what I do personally, that's not really my my goal or my passion, is to get into the political end, although I did. There's no question that the topic that interests me can become a political one and has become a political one, but it doesn't have to be. So I personally prefer to actually stay out of that realm, even though we're talking about it a little bit here, which is why with my current book, there's none of that. What moves me is talking about these issues in a way that is actually apolitical, believe it or not. I'm kind of gearing it that direction for you all, because I thought you were a political group, so I thought maybe I would do that. But if I were here talking, for example, about my book that's coming out, I really even wouldn't be talking politics. So I don't know. I mean, I think it has to be discussed, because so much of what feminists versus non-feminists want, they're two different things. So feminists go into the political realm. Why are you shaking your head?
Because I think that your that type of thinking of breaking people into groups and saying that they have opposing interests, when you're dealing with something as amorphous as feminism, which you choose to define for your purposes, but other people define it differently, is not helpful to the discussion either.
That's interesting because there's no question that people define feminism differently, and people are absolutely welcome to define it any way they want, but that doesn't make the agenda of the leaders or the ringleaders of the movement any different. So what I'm trying, by pointing out what that is, that doesn't make me, it's recognizing that something's happening and trying to address it. I don't know how else you can possibly discuss something and address it without calling it what it is, even if it ends up marginalizing people. I don't understand how you would do that.
Somebody might say that's talking like a man.
Huh?
those kind of categories that you're engaging in the same.
What category? If you mean feminist versus non-feminist?
By saying there's ringleaders and have an agenda and all of that, when it's really a cultural experience for all of us.
Yeah, I have three questions.
Okay.
Do you have a daughter?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Number two.
About to be 13.
Bless you.
I have a son too.
I have one of each, and I have raised them to be feminist.
Okay.
I am single. I own two businesses. I pay more taxes than most Republicans I know, and I do not depend on the Obama administration to bail me out. So I mean, that's just. But my question is, and well, I'll ask the question after this. And I am upset because you have touched a nerve. I've spent my entire life fighting for young women to have the equal opportunity. But to me, feminism means that they can stay home and take care of their children. Feminism is about a choice. If it were not for feminism, you would not be standing there speaking to us. So what is your definition of feminism?
So I don't define feminism based on what I think. I define it based on what the feminists who are the most vocal and outspoken and making the most headway with their mission define it.
What's the definition?
So the most recent definition that I can think of that I put in my last book was from Jessica Valenti, who is an outspoken member of the what they call the third wave feminist movement. And in that quote, she defines it as feminism is... I'm going to have to paraphrase because that was a book ago, I apologize, but something to the effect of a patriarchy, it's the recognition that the patriarchy exists and that it needs to stop. So in other words, if you were to ask the most outspoken feminists among us how they view the world or how they define it, I would bet you it's very different from how you do. So in terms of going back to groups, while you, it may mean something to you that's different from what the actual intent is. That's all I'm saying. So for example, let's go back to the choice idea and the statement that I wouldn't be here if it weren't for feminists. I'm assuming what you mean by that is that I wouldn't have, what, an education? Or I wouldn't have a writing career? Is that what you mean, if it weren't for feminists? So can you tell me, what did feminists do for me to give me my education and my career? Yeah, what did they do that allowed me to get an education and career?
Much like civil rights, they fought for your ability to have an entry.
To have a what?
And now, an
to have
entry
a what?
To the field.
Entry.
An entry to the field. And as it comes to the economics of the situation, there is no reason why my daughter should make less money than my son.
Okay, so...
They're equally intelligent and they're equally educated. And so feminism, in my opinion, and I've spent years and years and years fighting for it, is an equalizer. If my son chooses to stay home and take care of his children, if he has them, which hopefully isn't for a really long time, since he's 20, but if he chooses to stay home and take care of his children, that is his right and his privilege. But he doesn't have to. If my daughter chooses to stay home and take care of her children, that is her right and her privilege, but she doesn't have to.
Okay, so let's
but
go.
But what you said earlier about people who are single and who raise children without a father and that they're dependent on the Obama administration, that was inflammatory, which is back to the comment that we were talking before. It's inflammatory.
Okay. I heard three different things there.
maybe you can answer my question too. If I go to a movie with my wife, do I have to pay?
Only if she gives you the money.
Okay, I'm trying to write down because you have there's so much in there. Hold on, I want to. Can I answer?
Yes.
Okay. As to owing feminists, where did she go?
She's
here. Oh. Okay. How many people in here realize that there were women prior to the feminist movement who got college degrees and had careers? Raise your hand if you are aware of the women, not personally even, just know of them, who had college degrees and careers before the feminist movement. Prior to the 1960s. Have you read about them? Are they your mom, your grandmother? Okay. Where did they work? Well, let's see, my grandmother, she got a college degree, and that she was born in the 1800s. She became the librarian of the St. Louis Art Museum. She ran that library, actually, she ran it. My mother has 2 degrees, master's degree, and was a stockbroker for about 15, 20 years. Are you with me? I'm trying to answer your question. She was a stockbroker in the 1950s. She has a master's degree from Radcliffe. Not very many. There weren't very many. Do you know why? 2 reasons. Number one, birth control back in those days was not what it is today. What do you think most women were doing when there wasn't birth control? The choice that you're talking about doesn't come from feminists. It comes from birth control and technology. The fewer babies you have, the more time you're going to have to do something else with your life. That's number one. Women had a lot more children prior to the feminist movement. Technology is what frees women from the home. In every generation, every era, there was something that was created by men, I might add, technologically, that allowed the work on the home front to be less taxing for women so that they could then look elsewhere to do other things. It's time that women didn't have that they're having more and more of because of those things, birth control and technology. Birth control and technology did more for women than a boatload of feminists could ever hope to do. Go all the way back to disposable diapers. Do you know how a day was spent before disposable diapers? Picture yourself with 6 children and cloth diapers. What do you think you're doing all day? Washing diapers, right?
Let's get to the next question.
Oh, okay. I had the other 2 answers, but okay.
You can give it afterwards.
I have a statement.
Yes.
And I must tell you, I met Gloria Steinem very, very early in her career. They brought me into a meeting of feminists. And they told me if I could join their group, I could have my own credit card. I could have my own building that I could own. I could own things. And I was living in California. And I said, that's wonderful. I said, however, I have stock on the stock market, I have money in the bank, and it's under my name and not my husband's name. And I said, I think your movement is mute.
What'd she say?
She was shocked.
Most people don't challenge Gloria Steinem.
Right.
My hat's off
to
you.
I did. And I said, what are you going to do for me if I do this? Everything that you're telling me, I've already done. And I'm 25. She looked at me again. And I said, I think your word is not feminists, but humanists. And I think what you have to do is take responsibility for your behavior and open up both male and female areas. And don't deball, defang males in the process. I also think this is part of a socioeconomic problem.
Which goes back, yeah.
Yes, goes back.
Which becomes political, so that's why it's hard
to... Thank you for coming, but I just got the visceral all chewed up.
Well, okay.
Jeff? I had one question. You mentioned that that women see sex with men over 50 as they get the short end of the stick.
What? I didn't say that. Men over 50?
Isn't it true that with Viagra there is no short end of the stick?
I assume that's rhetorical. I said nothing about sex with men over 50. My husband's going to be 50 next year. This year.
Okay, one more question.
On that note, Jeff.
I love talking about sex. We can keep talking about sex if you want.
No, thank you. Actually, that was my point, too. Though, last night I did go to the Village Square event, and there was a lot of talk about sex and the rape. But one thing a couple audience members kept, I think, trying to bring up was the fact that, you know, you have so many both working parents and obviously single parents who are working because they have to. I mean, economics says they have to both work, and certainly the working mother has to work. I think one thing that didn't come up, I was shocked, and it didn't come up today in the discussion, was equal pay for women.
No, yes. Excuse me. That was the other note from her comment. Yeah.
And really, that's...
Sure, I'd love to talk about that. Yeah. Equal pay for equal work is one of those great sort of slogans, if you will, because who in this room would not agree with equal pay for equal work? It's almost silly because it's obviously we're in agreement on it. The issue is, A, is it even real? And B, what to do about it. So let's start with A. The reason women over the course of their lifetimes do not make the same amount of money that men do is because they do not work the same number of hours. They also do not work the same types of jobs. So yes, it is. This is not my words. You're welcome to read anything I've written in my books. It's all documented. Men continue to take the unpleasant, risky jobs that women don't want, such as climbing up onto tall, skyscrapers, for example. You don't see many women up there. And the number of hours that men work is steady. And so if you can kind of think of your life from like 22 to 65, you know, from graduating from school, let's say, to retirement, although I know they don't graduate at 22 these days. But throughout those years, if you look at your life in one long thing, women continue to voluntarily choose to take time out of that other path to care for their children. That is the decision and a choice that they make. And every time they make it, they are penalized, if you will, because that's not what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to, according to feminists, I'm saying, the idea is to work full-time, year-round, alongside the way men do. That's supposed to show equality. But then, of course, that begs the question of who's going to rock the cradle, right? If you have children, somebody's got to do that work. So whoever the person is that stays home to do that work for the family is obviously not going to be making the same amount of money over the course of their lifetime as the person who stays in the workforce. And traditionally, and still today, that person continues to be the wife or the mother by choice. Equal pay for equal work is a complete fraud. There is no such thing as this massive effort or discrimination against women, holding them down and keeping them from being able to make the same amount of money as men do. There's just simply nothing, no research to back that up. In fact, if anything, the research backs up the other side, the other point. So that's something that is used, of course, all the time by President Obama. And of course, who doesn't get all up in arms over that? Because unless you did the research on it and knew, it sounds so wrong. Because who wouldn't believe in equal pay for equal work? But it's not apples to apples. That's what I'm saying.
How do you feel about a woman president?
You mean just having one?
Yeah.
Sure, great.
Okay. All right. Okay. This was a very enlightening program. If it's a short question with a short answer, we could probably have time, so...
I'm not sure it's a short question with a short answer.
Well, then we... Okay.
First of all... Yeah. Tony, you know I love you. I'm a lawyer in this community, and I think probably in the last number of years of my career have been involved in what would be viewed as sort of non-traditional roles of women in the workplace. I have spent the bulk of my career probably as the first woman in the firm, you know, the only woman in the room, other than when I worked for Betty Castor when she was Commissioner of Education. I have to say that I was in college during this period when I read all the books. I took the class, Feminist Women's Literature, and I read Doris Lessing and Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. I subscribed to Ms. Magazine. I will say, even at that time, what was apparent to me was I've never labeled myself a feminist or not a feminist. I tend to think that the labels are problematic, and I appreciate the things that people have said at this microphone. But one of the things that I have to say that I observed through the process, I think is one of the things you may be saying, and that is, where was ultimately the respect for choice, for a woman's choice to decide to stay home and raise children as this movement was evolving? Which I have, you know, which I thought even at the time when I was in college, because if we really are talking about women and women being who they are and women pursuing what they want to do in the context of our society and our lives, choice is choice. And if you choose to stay home and be a mother and raise your family and work through that process, it should garner the same respect that a woman that chooses to be in a career and pursue what she wants should garner. So I think, you know, in terms of the whole conversation, you know, so much of it is based on what was then, what is now. If you were gonna, and I have to say, I haven't read your work, if you were gonna capsulize sort of the core of what, you know, of the core principles of some of the things you've written, like the title of today's lunch speech being the war on men. It might be helpful in conclusion for you just to summarize maybe some of the core points, because I kind of thought the subject war on men was a very interesting one, because I have, you know, never in my life blamed men for either what I was able to do or not do. So would appreciate sort of your thoughts on sort of the core messages and the range of things you've written.
Thank you. And actually, we could end on that. Actually, that would be great, because the reason I was looking down wasn't because I wasn't listening to you. I was trying to find the emails. One of the emails I got this morning, one that I got yesterday, the ones that I get regularly that say thank you, Suzanne, for standing up for the mothers of America. And the theme, the thread of all these emails, and it's not just emails to me personally, it's also when I do research for my work, I'm reading other people's statements to one another or comments online, or there's all kinds of places to get that information, not just emails. The common thread is that women today feel ashamed for wanting to love their families, for wanting to love a man and take care of their children. I don't know that's really interesting that you find that kind of funny, because I don't. I hear from them, and they're saying, I feel like I'm not anything if I do that, and I really want to do that. And is that, why is that wrong? Why isn't that condoned by society? Why is that not honored? And of course, the culture that we live in does not honor that. We are not family-oriented. We are achievement-oriented. We are money-oriented. We are status symbol fame-oriented. We have gotten completely away from family. And those are the people I'm trying to reach. They need someone to help affirm what they feel in here that they want to do, but they feel that the culture isn't helping them get there. Does that answer your question?
Thank you for joining us today for Capital Tiger Bay, and we hope to see you at our next meeting. Have a great afternoon.
Join us again for another delayed broadcast of a Capital Tiger Bay Club luncheon meeting on WFSU-FM.